tonight. Is it Grenier? Grenier. We'll be glad to hear from you.
May it please the court, my name is Peter Grenier and I represent the appellant, Ms. Terry Gandy, in her appeal. I'll be addressing two of our appeal, namely that the trial court erred in granting summary judgment to Sergeant Pittman on the 4th, the 14th Amendment, and the gross negligence and willful and wanton and conscious disregard claims, and with respect to Defendant Roby, that the trial court erred in failing to harmonize the jury verdict in the appellant's favor, that to the extent the verdict was irreconcilable, that the court erred in dismissing the jury in violation of Rule 49b-4 without sending them back to either deliberate further and or failing to order a new trial under the rule. And third, giving a special interrogatory that stated a subjective and therefore improper standard for qualified immunity where the proper...
Let me stop and just say, if you ladies want to have a seat over here, we'd be glad for you to... It just makes me nervous y'all having to stand up. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No.
It's
my client, so.
Oh, okay. Well, good. You can go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. And third, giving a special interrogatory that stated a subjective and improper standard for qualified immunity when the proper objective reasonableness standard was already properly included in the excessive force jury instruction. Now, with respect to Sergeant Pittman, as we know, Your Honors review this de novo because it was a grant of summary judgment, and you must view all the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, the appellant in this case. Sergeant Pittman formulated an ill-conceived plan that killed Mr. Gandy in his own backyard when he walked away from officers unarmed and was shot in the back several times. This can only be characterized as an egregious display of police tactics, and he blatantly violated literally every single aspect of his entire Department of Criminal Justice Services Academy training in dealing with suicidal individuals. First, he was required to request appropriate resources, such as a crisis or hostage-type negotiator who was available. He did not do so. He was instructed and obligated to maintain a safe position of cover while communicating with Mr. Gandy. He did literally the exact opposite. He was instructed to try to calm down Mr. Gandy. He did the exact opposite. He was instructed to try to identify Mr. Gandy's problems. Not only did he do the exact opposite by not communicating with Mr. Gandy, but he blatantly ignored Matthew Gandy, his son, Mr. Gandy's son, who was there on the premises trying to talk to Sergeant Pittman and to explain things to him. Sergeant Pittman was also trained that he should try to delay the person as much as possible. He did the polar opposite. Instead, he came up with a SWAT-like, what can only be described as, and he would agree, a SWAT-like tactical invasion or plan of ambush, going in there, and excuse my language, but I'm quoting, going in there balls to the wall and taser Mr. Gandy so that he couldn't respond. The plan was that Sergeant Pittman and Deputy McCullough were going to tase Mr. Gandy right away before he could do anything. And now I'm quoting from Deputy Roby, tase him right away before he can make any movements. And he was instructed by Sergeant Pittman that if Mr. Gandy moved at all, made any threatening motion like he's not going to comply, or a threatening motion like he's going to fight, then Deputy Roby, who had a 30-06 assault rifle, that meant that was the phrase when they talked about going long, he was to shoot him. That was Sergeant Pittman's plan. He instructed Deputy Roby to shoot him.
But that's not what happened, is it?
Well,
and what happened is, according to the officer, he shot because he perceived there was immediate danger to himself or other officers.
Your Honor, unfortunately, we can't know what would have happened because he so egregiously deviated from all of his training. And that would go to the Sales v. Grant, the effective causation argument as well. Because as this court has found that one can set in motion a sequence of events that would give rise to liability. And interesting, in Sales v. Grant, this court cited a number of cases holding that this principle of effective causation by indirect means grounded in the literal language of Section 1983 and in general tort law, citing Monroe v. Pape from the U.S. Supreme Court, holding that Section 1983 should be read against the background of tort liability that makes a man responsible for the natural consequences of his action. There was absolutely no time limit here. Mr. Gandy did not suggest that he would kill himself within X period of time. And any suggestion that he threatened to kill himself if he perceived that the police were there, well, that's all well and good. But every, by definition, every suicidal individual, is at that moment considering inflicting death on himself. So by definition, and subsumed into the training, is the expectation that a person who is suicidal may at any moment kill himself or kill herself. So with all due respect, Your Honor, he set in motion and came up with this ill-conceived plan that triggered this unfortunate sequence of events. With respect to the use of taser policy, Sergeant Pittman absolutely violated the black letter of the use of taser policy. It states that the taser shall not be used for subjects offering passive resistant behavior only. And passive resistant behavior, just so we're clear, is simply not doing something once an officer has ordered you to do something. That never happened. He specifically instructed others and planned to inflict two taser shots on Mr. Gandy. That was his plan. While Mr. Gandy, just to put it in perspective, was sitting calmly on a retention wall in his own backyard, smoking a cigarette, calmly speaking with his wife and his neighbor, Jordan von Schwanitz. None of the officers who looked in to the yard saw Mr. Gandy holding a gun. And in fact, Sergeant Pittman, according to Deputy Davis, who was there, Sergeant Pittman peeked in through the gate and observed Mr. Gandy sitting there on the wall, calmly speaking with Mrs. Gandy and the neighbor, Jordan von Schwanitz. There was no suggestion of any imminent threat to anyone. And let's be clear, the threat that Mr. Gandy made was only to himself. There was no imminent danger or any threat to anyone else. And in fact, as Matthew Gandy had stated, he was able to come and go as he felt in speaking with his father. Now, we brought four claims against Sergeant Pittman, as I mentioned. They're counts 1 and 2, 14th Amendment and 4th Amendment, as the case law suggests. Where the 4th Amendment stops and the 14th Amendment kicks in is somewhat murky, but we're really somewhat under the similar analysis, because no officer could have believed that it would be objectively reasonable or to think that it would be objectively reasonable to taser someone immediately and without warning when he's calmly sitting in his backyard having a conversation, smoking a cigarette, not threatening anyone, not suspected of any crime, and not resisting the police. They had no information that Mr. Gandy was threatening anyone else or that he put a time limit on when he would take any action. No reasonable officer would have thought that it would be lawful to act in direct contravention of literally every single tenet, every principle of his training from the police academy. No officer could possibly think that that would be legal. Otherwise, what do we have? What is this training for? Now, when we look at Graham Conner, we know that we look to the three considerations or factors with respect to whether there was a use of excessive force. And Graham v. Conner, in this particular situation, it almost arguably doesn't apply, because one, we look to the severity of the crime at issue. There was no crime. No one suggested that there was any crime. And in fact, under Virginia Code 37.2-808, Sergeant Pittman was actually required to have probable cause to even take Mr. Gandy into custody to have a mental evaluation. And in fact, in his training, he was trained that he had to observe the abnormal behavior, which at the time that he implemented his plan, he had not done so. If you believe what Deputy Davis and the others say, they all saw him sitting, he was sitting calmly on the retention wall. So the severity of the crime at issue, the first factor in Graham v. Conner, just simply doesn't apply. Whether the suspect poses an immediate threat to the safety of the officer or others. Matthew Gandy made clear to them that he did not. Whether he is actively resisting arrest or attempting to evade by flight. He was doing nothing. He was sitting in his own backyard. Now, we know that the Orem case tells us that one way to succeed on a 14th Amendment excessive force claim is to show that the police inflicted unnecessary and wanton pain and suffering. And
If there's no liability on Roby, can there be any liability on Pittman?
Yes, there can. Absolutely. Okay,
would you explain that to me?
Yes, absolutely. Under effective causation and the fact, effective causation under Sales v. Grant, number one, because Sergeant Pittman created this plan, and they were all subordinates, Deputies McCullough and Davis. Davis was a rookie, and Deputy Roby was also. They were all subordinates to him, and they were obligated to follow whatever he instructed them to do. So absolutely, they were, and I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, they were the tools of his ill-conceived plan. They were the tools of his ill-conceived plan. Now, certainly because summary judgment was granted, we
You're really not answering my question.
I'm sorry.
If there's no liability on Roby, how can there be liability on Pittman?
Well, there was liability on Roby.
If there's no liability on Roby, how can there be liability on Pittman?
Well, I thought I just answered that, but if I didn't, I'm sorry. I'm suggesting that Sergeant Pittman is what started, or who started, the series of events that transpired over a few seconds that triggered Mr. Gandy, not surprisingly, because there wasn't an announce, and there was at least a factual issue as to whether there was no announce, that caused Mr. Gandy to get up and do what he did. And if you believe that Sergeant Pittman also uttered the words shoot, then he was instructing Deputy Roby to shoot as well. So I think I could see a scenario that where Sergeant Pittman could be liable if Deputy Roby is not found liable. I hope I've answered Your Honor's question.
If Officer Roby had a reasonable belief that Mr. Gandy posed an immediate threat or causing death or serious bodily harm to Deputy Roby or to other people present at the scene, can there be liability on Pittman?
I think the more proper inquiry would be if an objectively reasonable officer on the scene in a similar situation as Deputy Roby, et cetera, et cetera. I think that would be what the standard is. So Your Honor's question was, could there be liability on Sergeant Pittman for that?
After the finding by the jury.
After the finding or by the
question four.
Yes, well, question four was improperly written. And we had objected to the defendant's jury instruction 18 at Joint Appendix 1028.
To that question? Is there an objection on the record to that question I asked?
Well, I candidly, Your Honor, when I heard the trial court state it, it sounded like it was right, and only later on, to be candid with the court, later on when I looked at it, I realized it was a subjective inquiry, and that was improper. But we had already objected to it previously on the jury instructions, which we had faxed over on August 4th, 2011, at Joint Appendix 1028 to 1029. We specifically objected.
Questions three and four consistent with each other, the answers?
Well, they can be harmonized. The reason they can be harmonized is because question four is irrelevant. Question four is a subjective inquiry. So certainly we can harmonize the two. If Your Honor is asking can they be consistent, I think they can because that's a throw-out question.
You're
number four.
You're saying then they can only be consistent in favor of the plaintiff. They could not be consistent in favor of the defendant.
Absolutely, because if we look at the excessive force instruction, it's specifically described, and the trial court had acknowledged that she wasn't giving a separate objective reasonableness instruction because the objective reasonableness language was already subsumed into, and we had a discussion on the record about that, was already subsumed into the jury instruction on excessive force. Now, with respect to the state law claims, certainly a jury could reasonably find gross negligence and willful and wanton misconduct and conscious disregard. And I'd like to make an observation here. During trial, Mr. Rosen, counsel for Deputy Roby, several times asked for or moved for judgment under Rule 50 on the willful and wanton misconduct. And what the trial court said in denying it, and this is at Appendix 1105, the trial court rejected that motion, and she said, I'll quote her, "Well, if in fact Mr. Gandy was running from the officers with no gun in his hand, his back was to detect Deputy Roby, Roby shouldn't have shot him, and that would be wanton and reckless in my view, with certainly enough evidence to let it go to the jury." That was after we introduced our evidence. What we're talking about here is way back at the summary judgment stage. And in denying the summary judgment, or granting the summary judgment to Sergeant Pittman, the court also made a statement which was just flatly wrong. The court said that, without allowing us to present any oral argument, the court said there's no standard of care that's been violated. Well, that's absolutely wrong. At Joint Appendix 106 and 212, Your Honors will see, we absolutely had police procedures experts opining on the standard of care and that there were egregious violations. It was Patrick Gallagher and George Kirkham, both eminently qualified in police procedures matters.
Why do you think on question four that's a subjective test?
Well, we look at the way it's written. And the way that it's written, it really does specifically go to Deputy Roby's belief.
They ask if he had a reasonable belief.
Right.
Why do you think that's a subjective test?
Because it says, do you find that at the time he shot David Charles Gandy, Deputy Neil Patrick Roby had a reasonable belief that Mr.
Who else
Gandy...
could it be?
Well,
tell
no.
The, did the shooting.
The way it would be asked and the way it should have been asked and the way it was instructed in the excessive force instruction was, do you find that another officer, a reasonable officer, in the same situation as Deputy Roby, would have believed his actions to be objectively reasonable or lawful? That's what the standard is. And it was properly stated in the excessive force instruction.
Whether or not the belief, even if it was a mistake, even if he's wrong, even if he does use excessive force, is his view of what he's allowed to do reasonable, objectively reasonable? And I just don't see where this question asks it in. It could have been asked in better language, perhaps clearer language, but I don't see it as requesting a subjective.
What also did not have a standard of proof, but I understand that's a separate. It didn't have the preponderance of the evidence standard. But, Judge, we can't get around the fact that assuming that the jury did listen to and adhere to the instructions, and if I may respond, I'm over my time, but then they had to have adhered to the excessive force instruction, which, as I said, contained the objective reasonableness language.
To what degree are you relying on the jury's answer to number 3?
That they considered that instruction and answered yes, that they found that he had violated Mr. Gandy's civil rights. You can't have objective reasonableness and a finding of excessive force. It's completely internally inconsistent.
That if number 4 went to objective reasonableness rather than subjective, that it would be inherently contradictory with number 3. Is that what you're saying?
If it went to properly stated special interrogatory that was consistent with the law and what was contained in the excessive force instruction, then we still have to look at the general verdict, because
right. But what I'm saying is, if the answer to number 4 can be properly characterized as being an inquiry regarding objective reasonableness, what is your position on whether the answer to 4 could stand with the answer to 3?
Well, I think it could, but I can't read question 4 that way. I simply can't. Because when you look at the excessive, and the jury didn't either, obviously, because they were told in the excessive force instruction, don't find for the plaintiff if you find that Deputy Roby acted objectively reasonable. They were told that. Don't find for him. It was right at the end of the jury instruction.
Okay. Well, let's hear from Mr. Rosen.
Good morning. May it please the court, Jeff Rosen on behalf of Deputy Roby. This is a sad case. It involved a very difficult situation for the police officers. And Deputy Roby, Sergeant Pittman, reacted and acted bravely and did the best and acted reasonably under the circumstances in a very difficult situation.
Well, Rosen, could we get to right where Mr. Grenier left off?
Certainly.
In in the verdict form and the special interrogatories? What is your position about 4? Is that an inquiry into objective reasonableness?
No, that is the judge's request to have the jury resolve a factual dispute so she could resolve the qualified immunity issue. That's what number 4 was. That was her request to resolve a factual issue, which made it unable for her to take and decide summary judgment.
Right, but it's going to the deputy's Deputy Roby subjective belief, or is it going to what an officer in Officer Roby's situation could reasonably have believed, which would go to objective?
It certainly goes to his objective belief, and I think he was properly instructed in the jury instructions. In the special interrogatory, the judge cannot repeat the jury instruction.
So you're saying it then inquires into whether it was objectively
Absolutely.
Reasonable.
Absolutely.
Okay,
Absolutely.
Then let's flip back to 3.
Okay.
If number 4 is an objective inquiry, how does number 4 stand side by side with number 3?
Well,
which
you can
says that the plaintiff has established that defendant Roby violated Mr. Gandy's Fourth Amendment right to be free from excessive force. How are those consistent?
Well, that is what qualified immunity is for. Okay, you can have a constitutional violation, but a qualified immunity protects public officials when they act reasonably under the circumstances. And that's the purpose of qualified immunity. And that's exactly why Judge Brinkema denied summary judgment to Shelley, because it was a factual issue. And she needed the jury to resolve it. And the jury resolved it. And you can have a constitutional violation, but if you act reasonably and the law doesn't tell you that your actions are improper, then you are entitled to qualified immunity. So I don't think...
But there's no issue here of this being a firmly established constitutional right, is there? I mean, aren't you trying to weave that into this case when it isn't even here?
No. I think that was an issue, and
either it was excessive force, and it shouldn't have been employed, or this was an objectively reasonable action.
That, yes.
This isn't a gray area on the law, is it?
Well.
How is this a gray area on constitutional law?
The issue is whether you can have an armed fleeing felon shot. There's no case on that issue. Whether when you have a fleeing felon who's armed.
Okay, who's the felon in this scenario?
Or an armed suspect, not felon.
That's pretty loose use of terminology.
Well, I apologize. Armed suspect. You have an armed suspect. There's no case on the issue when you have an armed suspect fleeing. He was suspected of threatening to kill himself, which is illegal. And
shoot police officers if they appear.
Correct. Correct. And
he said he'd shoot himself if the police appeared, didn't he? Did he ever say that he would shoot the police?
He never said shoot the police, but he did. There were two potential hostages in the backyard with him.
Yeah. No question. Mm-hmm. It's a volatile situation.
Right.
And really, you know, I understand these are difficult calls for the police.
They certainly are.
But my problem is with interrogatory 3 and 4.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how they could possibly be consistent with each other. That he could have used excessive force in violation of his Fourth Amendment rights, but yet he was reasonable in doing so. How can he violate his right to be free from excessive force and yet have a reasonable belief that he posed an imminent threat of causing harm? Aren't those inconsistent?
No, Judge, I think that clearly resolves the factual issue that Judge Brinkema had. Judge Brinkema had the issue. She was confronted with the evidence that the officers saw Mr. Gandy turn and point a dark weapon at them. And Mrs. Gandy and the next-door neighbor said, they changed the testimony, the statements they gave to the police when they said they couldn't see his hand, and then a trial said, they could see his hand, and he never turned. So there was an issue of fact.
Well, is it an inquiry as to subjective reasonableness or objective reasonableness?
I still think the test is objective reasonableness. I think that the jury instruction properly instructed the jury. It's a test of what a reasonable officer would have done under the circumstances.
A reasonable officer under the circumstances could have shot Mr. Gandy. Is that what you're saying that answer incorporates?
No, I think that answer number 4 says that the jury believed that Deputy Roby was in imminent fear of immediate harm to himself or another officer. That's what I think it says.
So he wasn't using excessive force. Wouldn't that have to be subsumed within that?
No, it wouldn't, Judge. It wouldn't, because it is a resolution of a factual issue. And you can have a constitutional violation and still have qualified immunity. And that's the circumstance we have in this case.
Under Willingham, the historical facts have got to be established in many cases, such as this. And number 4 decided that historical fact. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Judge.
In essence.
I'll agree with that, yeah.
And would it have been better, first of all, everybody agreed to the language in this verdict.
Clearly.
Correct. And the judge specifically said number 4 would deal with qualified immunity on
yes.
the record.
Correct? That was clear. That was the purpose.
And would it have been better just procedurally to have had the jury answer number 4 first And then if they answered as they did, instruct them not to answer number three.
Probably yes, Judge. I think that would have been a better procedure. Judge Brinkema selected the procedure. We talked about the issue and everyone agreed to it. Clearly, no objection to the use of the special interrogatory, and no objection to the setting aside the verdict once it came back. Mr. Grenier nodded, agreed, and there was no objection on either the special interrogatory or Judge Brinkema's actions afterward. And there was lots of discussion about how to handle it, and Mr. Grenier wanted to take and leave the qualified immunity issue up to the jury, Always up to the judge, exactly.
I guess what's hanging me up on this is the use of excessive in interrogatory number three. You're saying, and maybe I'm just not clear on this, but if the jury is being asked whether he violated the right to be free from excessive force, you're saying that he could still not be liable if he had a reasonable belief.
Yes, because that can be a constitutional violation, but he would have qualified immunity because he had a reasonable belief that there was an imminent threat of harm to him or the other officers.
Saucier help you in this case?
It does.
Doesn't that distinguish? I mean, as I understand Saucier, you can have a constitutional violation. You can have excessive force used. But that doesn't mean you're not still entitled to qualified immunity. You can make a mistake. You could use excessive force, but you were wrong, and you were wrong to do so. You made a mistake. But then the question is your mistake reasonable?
Exactly.
And if your mistake is reasonable, even though you violated the Constitution, then you get qualified immunity.
That's exactly
what we said. The intent of four was to get at that issue, I think.
It absolutely was.
But it has to be objectively reasonable. Right.
Well, the standard is objective reasonableness.
Right.
That's the standard. That's how the jury was instructed. They were instructed on that standard.
So how can these be harmonized if this question does not go to objective reasonableness?
The question is not for the jury. The question is for the judge.
Well, no, the factual question.
The factual question.
The dispute is for the jury. Then after the judge gets that answer,
correct.
Then the question of law becomes.
Exactly. So it was right. The judge submitted that factual issue to the jury to resolve, and then based upon their resolution, the judge then did her job, which was to determine the qualified immunity issue. And all along, Judge Brinkema said, this is a very thin case, but I'm going to let it go because it was a factual dispute. And she said that at the summary judgment hearing, and she said it at trial, and after trial she said, I would have done the same thing, probably found for the defendant officer.
Let me ask you procedurally in your district, just a question procedurally. When you have these cases where there's qualified immunity and historical facts, do any district judges bifurcate the proceeding just on historical facts?
Well, we try to get the qualified immunity issue resolved early.
Right.
But in this case, and we've seen more and more cases where there are very detailed affidavits submitted, picking apart each fact and trying to make a factual dispute. And so that bogs down and really interrupts the qualified immunity issue. We tried to have the issue raise it on appeal, and of course the appeal was sent back.
Mr. Rosen, does the qualified immunity issue, though, depend on the context of this case, of a gray area of the law?
Well, I think the qualified immunity...
If there's excessive force, then there has to be a gray area of the law for him to get off, doesn't it?
Well, the issue, is whether Deputy Roby could have known under the current case law that it was improper for him to shoot Mr. Gandy at the time.
So you're saying this was a gray area of the law?
There was no clear case on these facts. There was no specific case on these facts. If there are no further questions, I would respectfully ask the court to affirm Judge Brinkema's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Music.
Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Robert Music. I'm here on behalf of Sergeant Joseph Pittman. I'll address briefly the appellant's contention that the 14th Amendment applies here. I think that's an incorrect statement of the law. Graham versus Connor clearly instructs us that when we're dealing with a pre-arrest or investigative stop, use of force, the analysis is under the Fourth Amendment unreasonable seizure context. This was a truly difficult situation for all of the deputies who responded on the evening of June 29, 2008. Sergeant Pittman was the ranking officer, ranking deputy responding. The 911 dispatcher relayed 8 facts that were significant for Sergeant Pittman and the rest of his deputies. The first of which was that Mr. Gandy's own son called 911 asking for help. He informed the dispatcher that his father had a gun. He was behind his house in the backyard where it was dark. His father was intoxicated. He'd earlier had a domestic argument. He had anger issues. He was taking medication for mental problems. And most critically, that if his father heard or saw the police, he would shoot himself. That 911 call conveyed to Sergeant Pittman that Mr. Gandy had the means to carry out that threat. Deputy Pittman went through a number of scenarios. Of course, Mr. Grenier referenced training. Well, of course, Sergeant Pittman did receive training in dealing with suicidal individuals, mentally disturbed individuals, but none of that training involved the injection of the other facts in this case that distinguish it from a simple training scenario. Sure, absent the fact that Mr. Gandy was armed and had stated his clear intention that if he saw or heard police, he would shoot himself, perhaps the best method to approach this would have been to call a hostage negotiator or a SWAT team or to try to negotiate. But I think it would have been objectively unreasonable for Sergeant Pittman, given this factual scenario, in the face of the suspect saying, "I will shoot myself if I see or hear the police," knowing he has a gun, to then try to do the very thing to cause the suspect to end his life. in the complaint, the plaintiffs assert four causes of action that they suggest violate the Fourth Amendment, the first of which, with respect to Sergeant Pittman, was that in formulating a plan to seize Mr. Gandy, he violated Mr. Gandy's Fourth Amendment rights. The plaintiff did not advance any case law supporting this contention. There is no case law from the Supreme Court of the United States, this court, or the Virginia Supreme Court that holds that a law enforcement officer must formulate a perfect plan and execute it successfully or face civil liability. The formulation of a plan does not constitute a seizure under Fourth Amendment law. Failing to announce their presence, again, there's no constitutional right for anyone to have a law enforcement officer announce anything to them. In fact, the case law says there are certain scenarios where simply announcing any intention is a delay and could result in a death or injury to the law enforcement officer. With respect to the tasering and shooting of Mr. Gandy, Sergeant Pittman's taser missed. He did not taser Mr. Gandy. He did not shoot Mr. Gandy. The facts were uncontroverted that Deputy Roby fired his rifle and struck Mr. Gandy. The appellant has simply not put forth any cause of action for a Fourth Amendment violation with respect to Sergeant Pittman. I think the court correctly dismissed Sergeant Pittman at the summary judgment stage. His actions were reasonable. He ran through a number of options before deciding on the one he did. Tragically, it did not work out the way he had hoped, but his actions were reasonable and the court was reasonable, or the court correctly granted summary judgment in his favor. Unless the court has any questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time and rely on our brief.
Okay, thank you. I think we understand your position, Mr. Music.
Thank you.
Mr. Grenier.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll actually be very brief. First, with respect to Sergeant Pittman, let's be clear that there's no sovereign immunity, there's no objective reasonableness inquiry with respect to the state law claims for gross negligence and for willful wanton misconduct. And as the case law states, generally those are matters to be determined by a jury. Similarly, with respect to the assumption of the risk defense. So certainly, even if Your Honors were to find that there was objective reasonableness by Sergeant Pittman, which we would strenuously disagree with, certainly the state law claims there would be no such availability of that immunity.
Are you agreeing that this is a gray area of the law?
I'm not agreeing that this is a gray area of the law, not at all. Graham v. Connor sets forth very clearly three factors to consider. None of them apply here. As much as the appellees want, it's manifestly unfair and it's manifestly wrong to start the inquiry after they have ambushed Mr. Gandy and tased him. One of the prongs actually did hit him, and he looked down at it, and then he got up and walked towards his own house to try to go into his own house. I think it's also important because when we talk about harmonization, about what the jury found or didn't find, we will never know what that jury was thinking when they answered number three yes and number four yes, because we can speculate that they followed the instruction, the excessive force instruction with respect to objective reasonableness, and speculate that they harmonized it in their own minds as answering a subjective question, number four. So if we don't have a new trial with perhaps, and I think everyone would agree, cleaner and perhaps better ordered questions in the verdict form, then we will not know what the jury was intending when they did that. What we do know is that they left the courthouse that day thinking they had awarded Mr. Gandy's widow money and thinking that Mr. Gandy's civil rights had been violated. We know that much. Now, with respect to some of the facts of the case which Mr. Music touched on, I just want to also be very clear, because this goes into perhaps our, I don't want to say speculation, but our inferences about what the jury concluded. Let's be clear. There was a gun in a holster that we believe the evidence showed was not on Mr. Gandy's person or anywhere around his person after he was shot. He had so much blood coming out of his abdomen and his side and his back from where he had been shot that he fell face down into his own lower level living room in a huge pool of blood, and the jury was shown a picture of that, the huge pool of blood. One of the deputies testified that his left hand, which is the hand in which the officers seem to allege there was a gun in Mr. Gandy's hand, was outstretched. One of the deputies admitted that his left hand was outstretched to his side with no gun in it. They claim that when they rolled over Mr. Gandy's body, they found the gun underneath him. That's, well, let me ask you, there was no blood and no fingerprints. I'm sorry.
That when the jury makes a finding that he posed an imminent threat of causing death or serious bodily harm, was there any basis for them to make that finding other than that officer believed he had a gun?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think we're speculating a bit, because certainly the jury could have thought that...
I'm not speculating about their finding.
Well,
so what other basis could they have made that finding on if it wasn't their belief he had a gun? The officer believed he had a gun.
Well, let's say they did find that Deputy Roby believed he had a gun. Let's say they found that Deputy Roby testified and they believed that Deputy Roby believed that. That's not inconsistent with it being objectively unreasonable for another officer in that position.
I know, but you were arguing the facts that he didn't have a gun. But in the face of the jury's verdict on that and answer that question, I don't see how they would have any other basis for making the finding they did.
Well, I don't know, because it was so inartfully written.
Well, you know what the evidence was.
Right, we do know what the evidence was. There was not
any other evidence that a threat was posed to the officer other than the belief that he had.
No, Deputy Roby shot his rifle because he heard the word shoot. Because what happened was, just so we're clear, after they got in and they started this, there was yelling. And here's what I've inferred happened factually, that Sergeant Pittman yelled, or someone yelled, drop the gun, because they had assumed that he had a gun because they had been told that by Math And at the same time, Sergeant Pittman was yelling, "Mac," that's Deputy McCullough, "Mac, shoot him with the taser." So you're hearing, "Drop gun, shoot, Mac. Mac, shoot him with the taser." So you're hearing two people yelling over each other, which also goes to the ill-advised nature of this plan. They went in without planning to announce. They went in to, as Deputy Roby said, taser him like you don't even know we're there. It was supposed to be stealth. There was to be no announce. And again, that harkens back to the ill-advised nature of the plan itself. So if Deputy Roby is hearing words, then in his personal observations, maybe he believes that he had there was an imminent danger or threat of bodily injury to others. But, and this harkens back to your question about whether or not we could still have liability of Sergeant Pittman.
You're out of time. I need you to wrap it up.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think that concludes my argument. We would ask that Your Honors reverse the grant of summary judgment to Sergeant Pittman and reverse and remand for a new trial the verdict, or reinstate the verdict against Deputy Roby. Thank you.
Thank you.